Hi and welcome to the KEK podcast, a podcast from the Department of Human Geography in Lund. My name is August and I work here as a project assistant and I'm the host for this podcast. And today we're going to talk about human ecology, energy justice, together with Vasna Ramasar, a senior lecturer at the Division of Human Ecology at the department. Welcome to the pod.
Hi, August. I'm really excited to be here. These are topics really close to my heart, so looking forward to chatting with you.
I'm super happy to have you here as well. I was thinking before we start talking about the themes of today, maybe you can tell me a little bit about who you are and how you became interested in human ecology.
Yeah, of course. So I guess, I mean, just to position myself, I always describe myself first and foremost as a human, part of nature. But then some of the sort of identities which have shaped the work that I do are around being a cis woman, cis brown woman from the global south or the majority world. I'm originally from South Africa, but moved to Sweden in 2009. So I think a lot of that history has shaped me. In terms of my academic career, it has been quite mixed. I would call myself an interdisciplinary scholar. I started off studying geology and environmental science, moved into looking at health and environment, then did a second master's in development studies with a focus on political economy, and then a PhD in sustainability science with a focus on water politics. So for me, it's been about learning the different aspects of the world and how they relate to each other. And I've tried to bring that into the work that I do now in human ecology as both a teacher and a researcher.
So maybe you can tell me a little bit about what your research interests are right now and what is going on in your research life?
Yeah, I think I feel like my job is a privilege. Every day I get to work on really interesting topics. I also get to work on topics that to me feel meaningful because they have an impact in the real world. So right now, I would say that my research focus is in two directions. Mm-hmm. One of them is around environmental and social justice. And within that, right now, in this moment, I'm looking a lot at questions of climate justice, but also energy justice. And then the other aspect of my work is around alternatives to development, looking at what we have right now as a system which is unsustainable and seeing where are the possibilities of creating different ways of being, doing, and knowing in the world. So drawing from prefigurative politics, that means the work that people are already doing in the world that is creating a different future for humanity. So the projects, one of them is around navigating energy justice. Another project is around looking at workers as energy as agents of change. A third project is looking at women's resistance to extractivism. So all slightly connected, different contexts, Sweden, South Africa, Ecuador, global, and all things which I'm also trying to work with people outside academia to deliver this project.
This sounds to me also very much like human ecology. Yeah. And I think that maybe we can talk a little bit more about, because maybe a lot of people don't know that much about human ecology, but it is also a division at the Department of Human Geography. And maybe you can tell me a little bit about human ecology as a discipline.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. Mostly as well, because I have to say, I was not that familiar with human ecology before I came to Lund. Mm-hmm. It is a particular articulation of a discipline that is present in Sweden, but also in the US and now a little bit in Germany. So essentially, human ecology is about the study of human nature relations. Mm. And one could say that that happens in almost all disciplines. But I think we've taken a particular focus in really understanding what are the dynamics at play and what are the consequences of that. And we're very much interdisciplinary in the work that we do. So we draw on things like environmental anthropology or environmental history, or for my case, drawing from critical political ecology and development studies in how we ask questions of what are the relations of people with and in nature, and what are some of the consequences dealing with topics like what it means in terms of climate change, what it means in terms of culture and people's relationship to the land, to the biodiversity and ecosystems they're in. I would say that there is scope for a lot of different studies. We also have a master's program, which is called Culture, Power and Sustainability, as well as bachelor studies in human ecology. And just from the diversity of what students work in, really human ecology opens up a space for all aspects of human-nature relations to be studied with different methods and different questions.
So I wanted to ask you about this interdisciplinary part of human ecology. And from my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, it is possible to, for example, apply and be a part of the master's program in human ecology if you have a background in natural sciences. Is that possible?
Absolutely. So even though the division of human ecology is within the Department of Human Geography, which is within the Faculty of Social Science, in fact, our students come from quite diverse backgrounds.
So like biology.
Biology, we have economists, we have people with law backgrounds, we have people also with humanities backgrounds, philosophy. So people who have different backgrounds, but they're interested in similar questions. You know, what is happening in terms of the state of the world? What are the multiple crises that we're facing, and how are we seeking to address them?
Yeah, I mean, today with the ongoing climate catastrophe and everything about our environment and society, so many things are changing that really is captured under the roof of human ecology.
Yeah,
I picked up one of the concepts from human ecology, and that was slow violence. I think this is a quite interesting concept, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about that as an example of a human ecology concept, maybe.
Yeah.
Or is it a human ecology concept?
I'm not sure if the person who developed the concept, which is a scholar named Rob Nixon, would specifically call it a human ecology concept, but I think he would be very glad that we are using it within human ecology. And so the concept of slow violence is based on the idea that a lot of the environmental changes that are happening in the world right now are having an impact on particular communities in society, so that the impact is not the same for everyone. And I think this is an important point to make, because when we talk about the idea of the Anthropocene, or when we think about a common humanity, we sometimes make the assumption that we are all the same. But actually, with slow violence, Rob Nixon tries to bring up this idea that different people are differently impacted by the ecological crises that we have. And that part of how this is building up on social inequalities that already exist. So, for example, it might be people of color or working class communities who are situated next to the most polluting industries in an area. In another way, it could also be that it is people in the global south or in the majority world who have already faced colonialism, who are also experiencing now forms of extractivism for lithium or rare earth minerals, for example, which are experiencing again the impacts of climate change in terms of flooding or droughts in their areas. All of this impacting on each other is not necessarily creating one single event, which is very dramatic and acute, but rather is creating a long-term violence on these people's lives, which makes it very hard for them to maintain a good quality of life. So it's about how we build up all of these small impacts. And to give you another example of this would be to see what has happened in the Niger Delta in Nigeria. For a very long time, Nigeria has been exporting oil. For those communities who live in the Niger Delta, they've experienced living with polluted land, polluted water. They've experienced cancers and other health impacts, especially respiratory diseases. that affects their quality of life, affects their abilities to actually improve the place where they live. And so that in itself is a slow violence, even though you can't target one actor as being responsible for it. Right. So slow violence, I think, is really important. And a connected concept with that, to me, is ecologically unequal exchange. This is a concept that also comes from Marxist ecologists who talk about the fact that when we talk about trade, we put a price on things. But now we know that that price doesn't include all of these externalized costs on the environment, on labor, and on society. And so when, for example, we might trade an avocado from Colombia with Sweden, it doesn't include the labor that happens on for people working on these avocado plantations. It might not include the violence or the child labor that they experience. It doesn't include the embodied water and land, which by using it to grow avocados for us in Sweden means that people there might not be able to grow everyday food that they require. And so there's an ecologically unequal exchange because the price does not capture all of these embodied costs in terms of the environment and labor and society.
So thank you. I think that is a very interesting way of explaining the slow violence and how that concept is really capturing processes that are going on over a longer time and how we can understand and explain and do something about all these things. And it also relates quite much to another important concept in human ecology, which is environmental justice. So maybe you want to tell me some words about this concept.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, the notion of justice is a fundamental concept in the work we do in research, but also in research having a societal impact. And the reason I say this is because a lot of the work in human ecology is centered around ideas of sustainability, right? How do we actually ensure we live within the planet's limits and carrying capacity? How do we ensure equity in society and such? But we put a justice perspective on this because for a long time, a lot of these issues about climate change, about the ozone hole, about what's happening to biodiversity has been dealt with by natural scientists who come in with a very particular perspective. Of course, it's important that we get the information from them, that we have the knowledge and data, but how do we use that knowledge and data? And this is where the question comes in, is what kind of policies do we make? What kind of programs and initiatives do we put in place? And ultimately, in trying to find solutions to some of these sort of ecological crises, we have to make sure that the solutions also better humanity's existence, right? As I mentioned, with slow violence and ecologically unequal exchange, often we see the same marginalized and vulnerable people experiencing additional burdens from environmental costs. And that, to me, is an injustice. So environmental justice looks at how do we have a distribution of costs and benefits from environmental change across society. How do we ensure processes that are actually participatory? And how do we recognize these differences that happen? I have to say that a lot of the research we do in human ecology is more about environmental injustice than it is about environmental justice. But that is the goal and the vision that we're working towards. And I think also when I talk about environmental justice, I want to be very clear that the perspective I take as a feminist and decolonial scholar is that we have to view this in an intersectional way. So we don't see environmental justice or, for example, climate justice as just being about climate change. It's important to understand that when we're talking about environmental justice, we are also talking about social justice. We're talking about gender justice. We're talking about racial justice. We're talking about caste-based justice. So really, all of these aspects have to come together in a conversation about environmental justice.
Thank you very much. And I think sometimes all these natural sciences and sustainability and everything, it can sound as an objective kind of truth that is just out there. But bringing in these kind of perspectives also tell us why that is not the case, why it's not objective, why we need to consider many more dimensions of this than just numbers of, I don't know.
And I think if I can just jump in here, the other reality that we live with now is that for all of the decades that we have been doing development work to address social injustice, and then since the time that we started to acknowledge climate change and trying to act on it, we have not made the level of progress that we need to. So what we're seeing in the world right now is a huge carbon inequality in terms of the 1 or 10% who are responsible for emissions. They're responsible for 70% of emissions. And, you know, the lowest 50% of the population are responsible for 10% of emissions. In a similar way, where is wealth distributed? How are other inequalities spreading? It's not just that the knowledge and science and research we do is sufficient. Clearly, we're not heading in the right direction. So we need to change what's our priority.
That's a very important thing to keep in mind. And that's why I think also human ecology studies are so interesting usually.
So do I.
Yeah, that's great. But today the main focus is that we're going to talk about a sort of environmental justice, which is energy justice.
Yeah.
And in preparations for today, we've read an article that you wrote together with Henner Busch, Eric Brandstedt and Christians Rudus in 2022. And this article is called When Energy Justice is Contested, a Systematic Review of a Decade of Research on Sweden's Conflicted Energy Landscape. And I think this is also especially today interesting when there's a lot of public debate about how society is going to be electrified, as well as increasing energy prices and electricity prices that we experienced last winter and still today, together with the no longer imported gas from Russia to Europe, for example, and that Sweden needs to kind of build new energy landscapes. And in this paper, you set out to map the literature and conflicts related to energy systems in Sweden, and you're introducing a framework of energy justice. But maybe we can start on the other side. So could you tell me a bit about energy conflicts?
So I think that in terms of thinking about energy conflicts, we took as our starting point the notion that in the use of resources, there is always a trade-off. Mm. There are some who benefit and some who lose, and this can cause a conflict situation. So we have seen several environmental conflicts around the world. There's a very good online resource called the Environmental Justice Atlas that the Autonomous University of Barcelona has created, which documents some of the environmental conflicts that have happened. What we've seen is that a large part of these conflicts have to do with energy and the energy system. And that can be across a range of aspects. So from the production or sort of the extraction of certain types of energy to the transport of energy to how it is then used. And if I'll give you very particular examples, coming back to what I said earlier in the Niger Delta, the extraction of oil has led to a conflict between local communities who are living with the pollution and the state and oil companies. A more recent example of energy transport is what we have seen with the Dakota Access Pipeline in the U.S., where indigenous communities, First Peoples of North America, have been arguing against the transport of gas and oil in their territories because of the risks of leakage and pollution that might lead to Similarly, the Wet'suwet'en Nation are doing the same in their conflict of transport of gas in Canada. And then, of course, on the other side, we have where the energy source is used to manufacture most often electricity. Where I work in South Africa, we see a lot of problems and conflicts around people who live around big coal-producing or energy-producing coal plants because of the pollution that is resulting from that. So we have these conflicts where there is a use of energy in some way or part of the energy system that is then leading to environmental pollution or environmental impacts and social impacts. That means that not everyone around there is benefiting or even elsewhere is benefiting. And so people raise this as a contentious issue and say, we're not happy with the way this development is happening. That kind of conflict can be in many different forms. It could be very localized resistance that can happen in terms of people protesting or appealing a decision for a development. It could also be a case that one country could say that your hydropower development might be leading to us not having enough water downstream. So it could be international conflict that goes to an international law. So there are many ways that the energy conflicts can present themselves. But ultimately, it's about the fact that when we use natural resources, there is often a trade-off. Some people benefit and some people don't. And this leads to the kind of conflicts we have in the energy sector.
So when you then use this framework of environmental justice and energy justice to review research that has been done on these topics in Sweden, you talk about three dimensions of energy justice. And this is the distributional justice, the procedural justice, and the recognition justice. So I was thinking that we could maybe dig into these three dimensions one at a time and talk a little bit about how that research kind of look. So let's start with the distributional justice. Could you once again explain what this is and also what you found on this dimension from the research?
Sure. I think that, so the first thing I would say is that the energy justice framework was developed as a way of providing a simple analytical tool to understand what do we mean, what are the components within the box of energy justice or energy injustice. And in some ways, it is a slightly reductive way of discussing it, so in a way that we've simplified it so it's accessible to everyone. But I do want to state that obviously there are much more complex ways of thinking about energy justice. But as a simple tool, it is useful and it is one that policymakers and civil society can link to. The first of them then is this idea that you have these three pillars, distributional justice being the first of the pillars. And distributional justice, as the name says, is about how do we distribute the costs and benefits across society, across space, across the natural environment of a certain activity. So, for example, who is getting paid for or making profits out of, and maybe I'll take that example of, you know, the oil development in the Niger Delta as one, but who's benefiting from that? In the context of distribution, then, it's often something that is easy for people to recognize because we can physically see or say, yes, I can see that this benefit is going to that person. I can identify the material condition as in maybe profit and money, or the material cost as in increased air pollution that is experienced across places. With this particular research that we did look at how there was a distribution across Sweden in terms of, you know, different aspects of energy. And one thing I would say that has been quite important is when looking at distributional justice, a question of scale comes up. And by scale, I mean, you know, whether we're seeing something at a local level, whether we're talking about it in terms of regions, for example, Skåne versus Småland, whether we're talking about what's happening for Sweden as a whole, or also Sweden in its international role. So these the scalar dimensions of it. In previous times, there was a lot of conflict around the hydropower development that was happening in Sweden, and there was also some in terms of nuclear. But in more recent times, what we're seeing is that the energy and the distributional injustices that are most present in the literature, but also where the most present conflicts are in the public debate, are around the expansion of wind power in the far north of Sweden, in Sapmi territory, so land that is the land of the indigenous Sami people. And this is an interesting development, and I'd use it just as one example, because of the way we are looking to generate renewable energy, which is a good thing in terms of our international responsibility for climate change. We're trying to provide that energy for all of Sweden. So it's meeting needs of people that are distributed across the country. But the cost of it is borne by a very small part of the population, and that is the population of the far north. It's an area that is not heavily populated, but it is distinct in the sense that the Sami communities who live there have faced in their history colonialism by the Swedish state. They have lost their voice and their ability to participate. So it could be seen again as a form of slow violence. And so a lot of the conflict is because the distribution of the costs of wind power. And when I say wind power, it's that there's these huge wind farms that are put into the territory, which mean that reindeer herding is obstructed, which means that forests might be cut down, and the infrastructure for it changes the cultural, social, spiritual landscape.
And I think that is also important. I think that is, when you bring it up in this way, I think it also can be understood a little bit in contrast to the public debate about this in Swedish newspapers and so on, because then it's a lot about aesthetics of the landscapes. But here we have another form of a much larger cost that is actually impacting the land and the people of the north, which is hardly reaching the news in the same way.
I think for me, one thing that's really interesting in the Swedish context is how far Sapmi is in people's imaginaries. Like, a lot of people from southern Sweden have never been up there. So it's actually not something that they think about. It's not something that kids learn about in school. So this is also an interesting thing, because in terms of borders, it's the same country. In terms of national interest, it's supposed to be the same country. But in our imagination, we actually treat it as very different places, and we know so little about it.
Yeah, so that's very important to bring up. And I think this also relates a lot to the next pillar of this energy justice that you bring up in the article, which is procedural justice. And that is more about the process of actually building new, for example, parks with wind power and so on. And could you tell us a little bit more about this pillar and how that has played out?
So whereas distributional justice is one that people are probably most easily able to identify, in a lot of the work that we've done in this research project, Navigating Justice in the Energy Transition, procedural justice is the one that people raise as the most important. And by procedural justice, I mean that people are interested in the process of how decisions are made and who is involved in this decision. So a lot of this is about transparency and openness about information, but quite critically, it's also about who gets to participate, who has power, who controls the decision-making process. And this has become a really interesting issue, because if people feel that the procedures were fair, that everyone was engaged and involved and had a right to influence the decision. They might be more willing to accept an uneven distribution because they were part of that decision-making process. I'd give an example that maybe is not one that I talked about in the paper specifically, but it's another paper that we're writing up right now, which is about the Bränsleupproret, or the fuel revolt that happened in Sweden. So some people might be aware, but Sweden's largest social media or Facebook group is one associated with people who are critiquing the fuel changes and taxes that are coming up in Sweden and what it means for people who drive cars. And a critical point here is that people feel that they have not been engaged in the decision, that it comes from a top-down perspective, but also that their needs are not being recognized. So they're not participating, they're not being heard in the decision-making process. And so that actually led to a kind of movement that has been compared to the Yellow Vest movement in France, but not in the same way, because this has mostly happened in an online form rather than physical manifestations as it has been in France. But here it's about process, who gets voice. In the work that we're doing in Sweden, a lot of people in rural areas argue that there's such a focus on the urban centers that they are left out of the decision-making process. In other ways, people have concerns that decisions are made in Stockholm, the capital of Sweden, and so the concerns that they have elsewhere are disregarded. In other instances of procedural injustice, people feel that bureaucrats make the decisions without truly involving local communities in the process. So these are all dimensions of procedural injustice that mean that people are not comfortable with decisions and that can lead to energy conflicts.
Mm. And this is, of course, also an important aspect of it. And I think one interesting thing to add on to that is these conventions that you bring up in the article, which is both the Aarhus Convention,
yes,
which has three pillars, which is access to information, access to participation, and access to legal procedures.
Mm-hmm.
And first, I wanted to ask you if you could talk a little bit about how that convention has been implemented and if it has worked out when you looked at it in Sweden. And then I also want to bring up the ILO 169, which,
yes,
is another UN convention that has been... For the listeners that don't know, ILO is a UN agency that brings together governments, employers, and workers to improve labor conditions. And they have a convention called ILO 169 that Sweden is kind of infamous for not signing.
Yes.
So these two conventions and how these kind of global frameworks and documents impact and are implemented in these, in this pillar and aspect, kind of.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of the Aarhus Convention, you know, this is where I think energy conflicts become really tricky. And this is where we also ask the listener to dig deeper sometimes in what we read in the media, what we see in the newspapers, because they're never always straightforward. So in terms of transparency, in terms of participation and such, actually often the case is that people who are developing new projects will say, we did consult, right? So we did do the participation book because we did consult. But however, what we argue is that for it to be truly just, you actually have to think about how did you make sure that your consultative processes were inclusive, were in conditions that allowed people to engage. So to give you some very basic examples, where do you have your consultation meeting? Mm. Is it in Stockholm, which might be very difficult for some people to get to, or is it close to where you're doing the development? What time of the day do you have your meeting? Is it possible for people who are working to actually attend such a meeting? Simple things like that can mean that you do the work, but you don't always make it accessible. Similarly, you know, sharing the documents. If you share a 400-page report that's highly technical and then leave it in a public library, A, people might not access it, and B, they might not understand it. Right. So you have been transparent and open, But if it's available in the basement of that library and nobody's going to find it, then you're actually not furthering the process of participation. So I think in a lot of cases, people do follow the word of the law, but they don't necessarily follow the ethos of the law. And that's where we see the conflicts come in. ILO 169 is a little bit of an interesting convention because ILO is the International Labour Organization, but actually this convention is about Indigenous and tribal peoples. And so it's really important in terms of recognizing the special rights that Indigenous communities might have in different parts of the world. This also comes to the third pillar of energy justice, which is about recognition or justice's recognition, which is saying that there are particular groups who have special needs or special demands, special histories that need to be recognized, that we need to actually address. Now, in terms of Indigenous and Tribal Peoples Convention, the Sami communities of Sweden are recognized as Indigenous and First Peoples. However, how they are treated in Sweden, and Sweden is not a signatory to it, how they are treated in Sweden is very different. So there is a Sami parliament, but they do not actually have significant decision-making power in what happens in the Riksdag, the Swedish parliament, in Stockholm. So in some ways, people are concerned that it is very tokenistic. Right now, there is a case in Norway where Sami communities have been camped out and protesting in front of the Norwegian parliament because there was a court ruling saying that some of the development that was happening currently was actually illegal. However, even though that ruling was made by a court, no action has been taken to stop those developments. So these Sami communities are saying we need to see the action in line with that court ruling. And essentially, it is talking about recognizing the special rights that Sapmi and Sami communities can and should have in Sweden, as well as elsewhere, Norway, Finland, and such.
Hmm. Yeah, and that I think it's... we already talked some about this, but that we are sitting in a country which is Sweden, which has this kind of colonial history of the North. And I think in contrast to the mainstream media, it's also important to bring up that Sweden has actually not signed this convention. It's not taking this in a very serious way.
Yeah.
And it's also something, as you said, that is very much going on, both in Norway, but also in Sweden, when we're seeing this new so-called reindustrialization of the North and what is going to happen with this kind of development in the upcoming years.
Absolutely, because, and there's two points I would make on this. One is that a lot of people have this idea that colonialism is what happens when you go to places in Latin America, Africa, Asia, forgetting that actually there are colonial histories in Europe itself, as you've just said, August. Mm. The second part of it is that we've talked a little bit in terms of the wind power, but absolutely the reindustrialization of the far north is far greater in terms of what's happening with mining, what's happening with forestry. So again, slow violence because we're compacting various different forms of development on top of each other in a territory which is traditionally used for reindeer herding and in very different ways.
Mm. So let's come back to the article and the last dimension
yes.
of energy justice, which yes. is recognition justice. So would you give us some thoughts about how that is playing out?
Yeah, I think, I mean, this one and justice as recognition or recognition justice is probably the most controversial or least understood of the concepts. We draw a lot from a scholar, Nancy Fraser, in thinking about, you know, justice as recognition, but also understanding that it is hard to see and put together. So for a lot of the reviews that we did of energy conflicts, what we saw is that people conflated or put together procedural justice with recognition justice. So they felt that they were not recognized if the procedures did not make space for them. But I would say that we have to be careful of the use of justice's recognition because, for example, how one would see Sami communities might be very different from how one would see someone who is a landowner in Skåne. Mm. There are different histories that we have to take into consideration. Mm. And that comes back to my earlier point of the intersections of all of these. So I think that part of justice's recognition or recognitional justice in Sweden has been used in different ways. Our sense is that the full understanding of the concept is not always there. And so there's not always a good analytical frames that they work with that. But I do think that there is a lot of work that can and should happen in this area. And we're seeing that already in a growth of scholarship about what's happening in the
That was actually my next question. Okay. If you've seen, generally speaking, in research, a larger focus on these aspects than before.
Absolutely. I think that what we have seen is firstly, I think when I started working on my PhD studies, which is almost a decade ago, people were not talking about justice because it was considered a really radical term. So they would talk about things like access and allocation. And over time, we've seen justice being taken into the mainstream discourses. So even politicians using it now. That comes with its own risks because it's easy to co-opt the concept and use it to talk about anything and everything. It is definitely something I think that is important that we bring up that is at the forefront of the discussions. And then the other part that we've seen that has also changed is the opening up on the discussions and recognition of the colonialism of the far north, which that hasn't been in the scholarship and the literature maybe before the last 10 years, and there's much more coming out. And I think part of that is because we're seeing growing transnational solidarity of social movements who are highlighting what is happening in Sapmi. So I think that this is a place where maybe we're also learning from what's happening in the world out there that is now feeding back into the research environment. So to my mind, it's about time. I'm really excited. I think that there are some hard conversations to be had, but it's also important that these conversations go into the policy realm so that we start to move towards environmental and energy justice.
Mm, but that is also a difficult part of this whole debate nowadays with everything that is going on in society and politics and so on. And one of the last things that you bring up in the article, which we already highlighted a little bit, but I think it's really important to take into consideration, is of course as well that the energy landscapes in Sweden are not isolated to Sweden, but connected globally and internationally, both when it comes to importing carbon-intense commodities as well as exporting electricity to other parts of Europe or neighboring countries.
Mm-hmm. So I think one thing that is really interesting about the architecture of the multinational environmental agreements around climate change, for example, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, is that a lot of responsibility is put to the nation state, right? So countries are responsible for things. But equally so, countries get to do the accounting of their emissions based on their national borders, right? And what we know is that emissions are not that straightforward. Just as I mentioned, the energy system has these different parts. We also know in the world economy that those different parts of production, of transport, of use are distributed around the world now in different ways. So it's exactly these points that, you know, in Sweden's energy accounting or carbon accounting, greenhouse gas accounting, they might not actually account for all of the emissions that might come from the products that are created in China, for example, or the fast fashion that might be developed in Bangladesh or Thailand, right? So we get to the benefit of using those things, but those emissions are actually being produced somewhere else. Mm. In the same way, you know, there is a blurring of that, which means that we also don't fully capture, and I mentioned ecologically unequal exchange, embodied carbon is one part of that. So we don't fully capture how our lifestyles today actually have an ecological footprint far bigger than the boundaries of Sweden itself. And so we talk about this idea that there is an injustice here that happens spatially between Sweden and other countries, and something called carbon offshoring in a way, right? So that other people are generating the emissions, but we're the ones actually benefiting for it. So at the end of the day, Sweden might look like they're doing really well because a lot of the electricity is generated through renewables, but actually a lot of the materials we use are actually using resources that are fossil fuel related.
Yeah, I think this is very important to keep in mind, and I hope that our listeners think about this next time you hear in the news, for example, that Sweden has lowered our carbon emissions with this and this number since the 1990s. It's a quite usual thing that people say and politicians say, but then they don't take these things into consideration, which of course needs to be done as well. I don't understand how that can be a truth out there, that we're almost carbon neutral.
Exactly. I can look it up, but I don't know exactly the figures for Sweden. But Denmark, for example, a neighboring country, you know, their carbon offshoot day is the 28th of March, which means that they use all the resources available to them by the 28th of March, that they're available to them for a year. So it's that early. Sweden is doing a bit better. I'm not sure the exact figures right now, and I can look it up and we can edit this. But it is certainly an issue. And part of this for me is remembering two important points. One of it is the fact that even though we might have moved away from using fossil fuels in Sweden as much as we did before, other places it is still being used to produce what we need, right? So the global emissions is increasing as a result of it. And second is that even when we're making those moves to switch to renewables, sometimes the very ways that we want to achieve that can lead to what we call a form of green colonialism. Right. So just the idea that we should all switch to electric vehicles is something that we have to problematize. Essentially, the logic here is that, yes, there's a problem with climate change, so we need to get rid of all our fossil fueled vehicles. And so electric vehicles are the way to go. But electric vehicles use a whole lot of resources that are extracted from other places in the world under terrible conditions. Is it realistic that we should all drive electric vehicles? And what about the other alternatives, right? How do we consider, how do we have better transport systems, better collective transport for people? Right now, we're seeing a situation in Sweden where actually some of the services like bus routes are actually being taken away from rural areas. This makes an injustice for people living in those areas because they are dependent on cars. And then we're saying you have to have an electric vehicle. So it's kind of a double whammy on these communities. So there's a problem in the green colonialism, in the cost that we place on places elsewhere in the world. But also in this technology-driven future, there's sometimes a cost of people being left behind in Sweden as well.
Mm. And this is also important to keep in mind because there's a lot of things coming up right now on the EU level of different legislations trying to adjust these kind of relationships.
Yeah.
And that is also another article that we read for today about how Europe's new green new Green Deal could be also a new green colonialism kind of. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is also part of the research that I'm engaged in the human ecology division that is also quite close to my own heart because I come from South Africa. It's a country where we have a lot of fossil fuels, a lot of natural minerals. And so there's a history there that I recognize. And so the European Union right now are negotiating around a Critical Minerals Act and other resources as part of the European Green New Deal. The US are also doing the same in terms of their Green New Deals. What I think is very important to keep in mind is that yes, we have to decarbonize, we have to reduce carbon emissions into the atmosphere. And this is where energy justice and environmental justice comes in. In the way we do that, in the solutions and technology that we find, we should not risk exacerbating the injustices of the past. So very tangibly, like I mentioned, rare earth minerals, lithium that is being extracted for electric vehicles and such, right? They are done so under conditions of slave and child labor. There are huge amounts of pollution that are happening in Peru, in Chile, for example. We're looking at challenges in the Congo. We're displacing the burden of creating this green technology, this green growth for Europe, onto someone else, and that in itself is extractive. So it's creating a destructive system where the distribution of costs and benefits is unfair, the procedures are unfair because Europe is making these decisions without huge amounts of negotiation with local communities or workers in those areas. And it's also not recognizing the legacies of colonialism and such, which are a further aspect of injustice taking place.
So now we have almost talked an hour, and I wanted to start summing up the episode a bit. And I was thinking for the listeners, what do you think that they can bring with them in their everyday life from the research that we've been talking about today, as well as the research going on in the Human Ecology Division?
Yeah, I think that there are a couple of things that I would like to bring up for people. One of them is that, yes, the situation is pretty dire. You know, we're racing against the clock in a sense, because we know that there are so many aspects of the ecological systems that are close to collapsing. And so action is needed. What I would say is that, yes, people need to take actions. And I'm always happy when someone is recycling or using a straw that is reusable. But it's also to remind us that there are bigger structures in place, right? And so it's the decisions that our governments are making, it's the decisions that the EU Parliament are making, which also play a big role. So in some ways, how we engage in terms of how we vote, how much these issues of the ecological crises are on the agenda of the different political parties that we vote for, is something where we can have an impact. Another aspect to me is that these are all so complicated because every solution has its own problems. And it can make people feel that they don't know what to do. For me, it's important that we all find the small spaces where we can act, do the best that we can. And some of the best places to act are also to find ways to engage with others, right? Get more involved in activities that are happening in society. Go to teach-ins, go to, you know, places where you can learn more about the issues. So we all get more knowledge, but also we build community and start to do things in different ways. And then I think my third thing on this is also, it's so easy and it's such a privilege that we live in relatively good conditions in Sweden. Mostly we are not feeling the worst effects of climate change. So we can lose sight of what is happening in the rest of the world, and we can lose sight of how the choices that we're making are impacting on that. Sometimes that means that we need to rethink the lifestyles we have. Do we have to have fresh flowers every Friday? Do we have to have avocado in the store every day? Maybe those changes need to happen. So thinking a bit about the structural aspects and how we can affect change there in terms of our voting, thinking about how we can take action, doing so in more collective ways, and then finally thinking about our choices, our lifestyles, but in a bigger context of the world and how it affects others and nature, are three things I think are important. At the end of the day, we all have to just take our small steps and our big steps to do so. And there's no perfect answers, but get involved.
That's a good answer to that question. And I also asked you to bring a learn more advice for the audience. And what did you bring if someone wants to learn more and know more about these topics?
That was so hard for me. I really struggled to think about what are the best things that I wanted people to think about or learn more from. Maybe just because we're on a podcast right now, I wanted to direct people towards a podcast by the Climate Justice Alliance called Stories from Home, Living the Just Transition podcast. I also wanted to put a plug for a movement that I'm part of, a process called the Global Tapestry of Alternatives. It's a process of trying to weave together the alternatives that already exist, where people are trying to create different ways of living, being, and knowing in the world. And there's lots of good examples to remind us that actually there are other ways of doing things. There are other ways of creating a good life. So, yeah, the Stories from Home podcast, Global Tapestry of Alternatives website. And then just for a little bit of inspiration, if people have a chance to look up either online or if you get a chance to visit an exhibition by Sebastio Salgado. He's my favorite photographer. He has these amazing series about workers, which just bring closer to home for all of us what we've been talking about and how some of the injustices play out.
Thank you very much. So before we wrap up, is there anything else that you want to add?
I mean, I think that there's a lot of exciting work going on. There's a lot of interesting things developing. If you want to know more, get in touch or look at our human ecology website. We have a fantastic master's program and bachelor program. So if there are any students out there listening, I encourage you to take a look. Maybe it's something that would be interesting to you.
So thank you for listening to this episode. And from the podcast, I also want to say, if you want to contact us, you can find information on the website keg.lu.se. And I also want to say, don't forget, subscribe, share and like this podcast so that more people can hear it. Hear from you again soon.